The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Good morning, Long Island, and welcome to DDI on Autism on 103.9 FM, keeping an eye on autism and giving a voice to its Long Island community. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Romas, and so glad that you can join us this morning. Well, let's start right away. You know, it seems that although there are major gains have been made in the last two decades in normalizing, including, and integrating people with intellectual disabilities into the community settings, their sexual health continues to be overlooked. And that's why I'm particularly excited about this particular conversation. My guest today, Connie Senior, LMSW, Assistant Coordinator of Sex Education and Clinical Curriculum Development for the Training Department at YAI. Connie, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for making this time. You know, as I started to suggest, I think the issue of sexuality in relation to persons with intellectual disabilities feels, at least to me sometimes, kind of like the final frontier, this precipice that we come to over and over again and are often afraid to cross. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It still happens to be one of those hush topics. You know, the word is even whispered and definitely not addressed. I think naturally parents don't often like to talk to their children about sex or, you know, anything related, but even more so when it comes to parents who have children with developmental disabilities.
I think that's right, Connie. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I reflect on that, some of the reticence is understandable, I suppose, given how vulnerable that population often is. And since the consequences of irresponsible or ill-conceived sexuality can be pretty extreme, the concern, I think, is understandable. But I also would suggest that it runs a little deeper in terms of the way we conceptualize and see people with disabilities.
Absolutely. You know, you are right. The fear of parents that their child will be taken advantage of. Society historically has seen people with developmental disabilities on either end of the spectrum, either as proverbial children, so, you know, seeing them as asexual, not having any interest in sex at all, you know, even as adults, or to the other end, where they're seen as hypersexual. And often are depicted in that way. So you understand why with those two views, you know, especially the view of them being asexual, then why would they be interested in sex? Why would they be developing as any other neurotypical teenager would during puberty? Why would they have the desire to want to have children or just simply, and you know, having the need to love and be loved like everyone else?
Yeah, I very much appreciate the way you put that. I think that's so true. And you know, I think there's at least a couple of dynamics in play here. I mean, certainly this idea of what has been termed infantilizing people with developmental or intellectual disabilities, and kind of in our minds, or in some people's minds, keeping them as forever infants or children, not fully developed, not fully able to feel there's an experience sexuality. And I suppose part of that, Connie, maybe you can speak to this a little bit, is also with some intellectual disabilities, there's also challenges around self-expression, sometimes communication, and if you're not able to make your needs, or in this case, your wants and desires known, how do you have them resolved or reciprocated?
You know, often people think that adults or people who don't use words to communicate aren't communicating. But they absolutely do communicate, mm-hmm. and they do understand. They're just not communicating with words. You can teach someone at a lower with lower cognitive abilities to indicate no, mm-hmm. to scream or yell if something is not right. They can, if they can say no to not wanting soda or coffee, they can say no to someone touching them that if they don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just need to teach it.
Well, that's true. It's important to give people the tools to essentially navigate and hold tight the boundaries of their own sexuality. And just as you suggest, you know, a language would be one principle, but it's not the only means of making both your needs and your constraints known. I've certainly worked in this field for so many years at this point, and would agree with you completely, Connie, that, you know, language is only one vehicle of expression. And certainly in the world that I have worked with, very often receptive understanding of issues and receptive language is far greater than expressive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And people often see one disability and use that to look through the lens for that entire person when that is not so. You know, they still feel, they'll still have the same needs as someone who is neurotypical or someone who can use words to communicate. It's about finding out how that person learns and then teach them the concept in their zone of learning.
That's interesting, very interesting to me, and certainly the way you phrase that. And also this idea of what needs a person with a disability does or doesn't have. And I think you and I are in agreement that all human beings have sexual needs. That's the nature of biology and the nature of DNA. But I would qualify that by saying, depending on where a person might be developmentally, the object of that desire, the object of sexuality, might vary a little bit. So someone who's working in a cognitive level that's extremely, extremely delayed, someone who might really be functioning at a very challenged level, what that sexuality might look like might be different than someone who's far more advanced, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Absolutely right. And when people hear the word sexuality, they automatically just focus on the first three words, mm-hmm. sex. Mm-hmm. When it isn't, sex is a very small part of sexuality. And you are right that for some people, they may want actual sexual intercourse. For others, it may just be someone to hug, someone to touch, because we all have the need to touch. We mm-hmm. all have the need to love and to be loved and to be accepted and for approval. So for someone else, it may just be someone to hold their hand.
You know, it takes me all the way back to those early studies. I think it was the Harlow monkey studies, and this might be familiar to some listeners, where they were experimenting with these poor little monkeys, and the ones that didn't have physical contact, you know, were the ones that failed to thrive. And that primal primate, human beings, all creatures, but certainly primates, we have this need for physical contact, and sometimes that's reflected in sexuality. But as you were just suggesting, and I couldn't agree more, sometimes it's just that need for hugging or just some kind of physicality.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we age and as we get older, yes, there is the touch, the love of the parent, but in development, and especially as you go through the emerging adulthood stage, late adolescent and emerging adulthood, you now start looking outside of the family for that touch. So you still understand that there's a family touch, but developmentally for everyone, we then have the need for that special person, that friend, that person other than the parent. And I think this is where the struggle is with parents, that they're not realizing that that's a normal, natural developmental need.
So the challenge then, Connie, for people like yourself and myself is sensitizing, you know, families and parents to what is often a likely reticence or resistance to kind of going there, if you will, and, you know, but doing that in a sensitive way and kind of understanding, as you do, that it's natural for parents to kind of be a little reluctant to pull the trigger on this. But they also, I think, need some guidance in how to proceed. Like, how do we foster and facilitate someone's sexuality, someone who has a significant cognitive disability, but still keep them safe?
And that is true, right? I'm a parent, I'm a grandparent, and I absolutely understand that fear. When I talk to parents, I talk to them about social sexual education and the benefits of it. I see adults with developmental disabilities in our systems who are still working through things that weren't handled well when they're children. Mm-hmm. So not understanding that things like masturbation is not a bad thing.
I think, you know, I think just you're broaching another sensitive and I suppose a difficult area for a lot of people to kind of talk about. And that, you know, we're about to move to a very short break, but that's just where I want to pick up when we come back. Connie, I'd like to talk a little bit about what sexual education looks like on behalf of people with intellectual disabilities. And then from that, talk a little bit about some of the challenges around giving informed consent. And again, ensuring both the experience, the full experience of being a human being, but while also staying safe in the world. So stay with us. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Romas. The subject is sexuality.